Hello, everyone, and welcome back. It's Richard Land for Set for Success, where we help you create a roadmap to transform your business, career, or life. The other day, I was chatting with a group of business associates, professionals, and I asked an important question, or what I thought was an important question, and really what it was is what's important to them in their business and careers. Interesting enough, one question created a lot of dialogue. Initially, responses were all over the map. They range from success in what I do, innovation and creativity, daily challenge and appreciation, a clear focus and direction, better communications, and dedication from the people around me. So I asked, what one thing would be required in order to have all those things? Everyone sort of scratched their heads and wondered what they would be or what their needs would be. Now, I don't really believe there's one answer to this question, but this group of professionals landed on the word performance. So I joked that it was, some joked that it was what their bosses wanted. Others said it made sense to them as you had to have consistent performance in order to be able to achieve things. Of course, at this point, I just sort of smiled and thought to myself, well, isn't that really what the setability factor is all about? Isn't that really what Set for Success is all about and what I wrote in my book, Set for Success? Figuring out what to focus on, moving towards those things and placing some performance measurements in place to know that you made it. I do suspect there's more to performance than what I just stated. For example, I do know from experience that performance has something to do with lived experiences, personal development, and a willingness to go beyond your own ceiling. And how many people have their own ceiling? You know, you go so far in life, the things that you do, and you just stop. You don't go beyond that. Can you break beyond your own ceiling? Maybe that's performance too. The word performance is something that exists everywhere, right or wrong in our society. I know some people don't even like the word performance, but if you think about it, look at sports. The life of an Olympic athlete, an Olympic star, or a successful talk show host, a leader of a country, a successful entrepreneur, somebody who's really done well in their career overall. I suspect performance had something to do with that. Performance is the part of their existence overall. Yet sometimes we reject performance. I know that back in the day when I worked in the corporate world, I hated the annual performance review. I did not enjoy it at all, and I have no problem saying it, but I did learn some very valuable lessons about myself. On the one hand, I guess, you know, when you look at performance, you could be talking about KPIs, key performance indicators. And I know these days I run a company in the last 15 years called Brave World, and I don't hide that fact. And we do a lot of strategic planning with clients and working with organizations, and we're always looking at measuring performance. Even when we sit down and we talk about what we're going to do next, we decide and make some decisions, then we have to talk about the measurements and what performance looks like. So you can sort of guess what we're going to talk about today on Set for Success. We're going to talk about performance with my guest, Dr. Jason Brooks, performance coach and consultant.
Thanks, Richard. It's great to be here.
Yes, I'm glad to have you. I'm quite excited. I always like to speak to various experts about the things that are going on or what they focus in on in business. But Jason, I always like to start off with a very simple question. Just tell our audience, our listeners, a little bit about yourself.
Sure. Well, like you said in the introduction, my background is performance coaching and consulting. I guess the origin story I can spend a bit of time on. I was a fairly successful athlete back in the day, but not as talented as some of my peers. And so I was always looking for some way to gain a bit of a competitive advantage, if you will. And so I started to gravitate towards more of the psychological end of things, you know, performance psychology, to see if I could make some inroads there. And so that really fueled my interest. And lo and behold, many years later, I decided to pursue that as a career. And so I first kind of cut my teeth in the world of sport psychology in terms of performance. And enjoyed every moment of that and still work with many athletes today.
So just since you're talking about sports and everything, and you said back in the day you were an athlete. So now, you know, we have to ask the question, what was your sports? What were you into?
Sure. Well, my dad was a high-level wrestling coach. So that was one of the first sports I
got into. Remind me never to get into a brawl with you.
Well, those skills have long since faded. Age and lack of repetition for sure has contributed. But it was an amazing thing at an early age to be part of and something I could share with my dad, which was great.
Yes.
And then I'd say my main sport was football growing up. And I actually played quarterback for most of my career. And so I think the idea of leadership and performance psychology was ingrained in that position. I mean, when you're standing in the huddle and all eyes are on you, you know, they're looking to you to say the right things and communicate the right things and imbue a sense of confidence. And so, again, I think that also intrigued my interest to be better at that position, so I started looking these areas.
It is definitely a position where performance is key. I mean, if you could say, for the quarterback, all eyes are on you. You know, it takes a team to be successful, but when it comes down to it, if you don't make that pass, or you fumble the ball, or something happens, you know, what happens, right?
You're
judged right away. You know,
and there's a great line that I think applies as much in sport or in business. And that's that sense that calm is contagious. So as you say, if and when there's a setback or a misstep and they're looking at you, that moment that you have to project that sense of, you know, we got this, we're going to make the adjustment, we're going to go forward, versus panic is also contagious.
Yeah.
So, you know, if they're looking at you for guidance and to be that rock steady, you know, sense right there, and you're projecting the opposite, you know, you look flustered and frustrated, I mean, that's going to have a contagion effect. So I think instinctively, you know, part of playing that position, it was another reason why I was so interested in exploring the world of high performance.
Yeah. I've got to ask a couple little questions. I mean, I know we're going to get into the whole idea of high performance and everything, but I need to know, like, did you play in Manitoba? Where did you play?
Yeah, I played. I mean, I only went to the level of high school.
Okay.
I had a few opportunities perhaps to continue on, but, you know, the writing was on the wall. I just wasn't talented enough, let's be frank.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, but I enjoyed the psychology of performance so much that, again, I just kind of channeled that in a different way, in a different direction.
Okay, so now these days you're a performance coach.
Yeah.
Okay, and consultant. So let's talk about that journey a little bit. If we just assume, let's just say that, you know, this happened somewhere after high school that you decided this, just to give us a break point, right? So what's been the journey in terms of developing your own career? I mean, I refer to you as Dr. Jason Brooks. So what's been the journey in terms of your education to build up your knowledge set in that space?
Well, I did my undergrad degree at University of Winnipeg, and I did a double major in kinesiology and psychology. And it's interesting because, again, having started more so in the sports psychology realm, there's a lot of the history of sports psychology. I would say it's about 50-50 in terms of some people go the more clinical psychology route, but a lot of people go the kinesiology route,
yeah,
which makes a lot of sense. You're consulting with strength trainers and nutritionists and more of an interdisciplinary science model, right? As you'd know.
Yeah, because I'm always working on stuff.
Exactly. And so, and I was very fortunate. I mean, you talk about just timing of life. You know, one of the legends literally in the field, Dr. Cal Botterill, who, you know, we always tease him, he's probably the least successful person in his family, and that's saying a lot for someone who's in the Hall of Fame as he is. Both of his children have, you know, done amazing things in the hockey world, and his wife is a 2-time Olympian speed skater. But Cal couldn't have been more accessible to me. He couldn't have been more gracious with his time. And all he cared was that I, you know, showed interest and matched that with commitment. And so I always tease people. I had a PhD in performance psychology long before I actually had a PhD, just because he was so good
at such a great mentor. So maybe what we'll do is we're going to have to take a short break, but we'll come back and maybe we'll kick off with the idea of mentoring. This is Richard Land for Set for Success. We'll be right back. Hello, everyone, and welcome back. I'm hanging out today with Dr. Jason Brooks. Jason is a performance coach, and we were talking a little bit about his background. And just before the break, we were talking about the importance of mentorship. And you mentioned that you had a mentor earlier on in your career. And who was that mentor again?
Dr. Cal Botterill.
Dr. Cal Botterill. Did I get it correct?
Correct, yeah.
So let's talk a little bit more about that. Like, what were some of the things that you learned from your mentor that maybe you apply today in your life?
Sure. I think the biggest thing, I mean, from a 60,000 foot view, what did he do for me? It's the classic, you know, adage, because he believed in me, I believed in me. I mean, just to give me that sense of confidence early on that I could do this, you know, to allow me the space to scrape my knees and learn some valuable lessons, knowing that it was safe. I mean, he provided a bit of a safety net. We can go for a coffee or go out for a lunch and explore things I did do or should have done or could have done. And he was always there just to help me pick up the pieces and to encourage me to keep pushing, to keep striving, to get better.
It's interesting you would say that, because I'm a believer that the mentor picks the mentoree, but the mentoree picks the mentor, right? So it's sort of a that relationship. And I had, early in my career, I had a relationship, a mentorship by a gentleman by the name of Rene Abbey. Same idea. And to this day, I still, you know, watch what he's doing in his life and everything. He's quite a bit older than I am. But he sat me down when I was in my mid-20s, and we talked specifically about my career and about what to focus in on, the things that I wanted to do. And he actually helped me outline a roadmap for my career at like 25, 26 years of age. Now, I would have liked to have had that at 20, but I was too young. Like the, you know, the maturity psychology level, right? I just share that with you because I'm, you know, I think it's great that you're sharing that you have a mentor that you had earlier on in your life, maybe about the same age as me, I don't know, at my time, but it really made a huge difference.
Oh, massive. And I'll tell you this, one thing that Cal did that I encourage anybody in any leadership position with regards to mentoring to consider is the trade-off value. I mean, Cal made it very clear early on that if I'm going to commit time to you, the expectation is you're going to make me better also. This is not a one-way relationship here. It's a mutual thing.
And I think that's the distinction between mentorship and other types of relationships that you have with people.
Precisely. I mean, he would be the first to tell you that that's been key to his success, is hanging around young people who make him look good. I mean, he's underplaying how incredible he is. But there's a lot of truth to that, too. I mean, it's helped kept him current and vibrant.
It's interesting you would say that, because I want to share this story, too. This is all about sharing. I married into a large family, and then with a lot of extended friends, right? So in that, and we're all now at an age where we have kids that are now young adults, and we have grandkids or great nieces and nephews and all that stuff. And my wife will joke with me that, you know, when we're at an event and everything, I always end up hanging out with the younger people. I know that a lot of the adults and everything will hang out together and everything, but I find that there's incredible value by going and having a conversation with somebody who's 25 or 20 years of age and getting insight into what they're doing and then providing them insight into your own life experience. But that's that sharing. And you both learn, right? It's not about telling somebody what to do. It's about both learning from each other.
Absolutely.
And I think that's what you're sort of saying with that particular statement.
Precisely. I mean, someone who is more junior, let's say, or earlier on in their career, but they might be more current in terms of the latest technical, you know, advances in terms of knowledge and skill and what have you. And so again, someone who's more senior, they're largely going by instinct at this point. They've been in all the situations. So again, if we value continuous learning, which is a buzzword, and most people, the best performers I've been around do, then it would make sense that we'd connect with people who can provide us that constant stimulus.
Yeah, I would agree with that too. And I know, continuous learning is a bit of a buzzword, but, you know, do you like to learn all your life? I mean, that's really what it is, or educate yourself all your life and build beyond, you know, what you're present knowledge base is. And it's an important part of, I guess, performance.
Absolutely it is.
Yeah. When we get into services, like we were talking a bit about your career, and that really kicked off your sort of your undergraduate career, because then you went and did a master's degree and eventually your PhD. What did you do your master's in, and where did you do that?
I did it at University of Manitoba under Dr. Dennis Rusenko, who was just fantastic. I looked at critical incidents of adversity. And in that time, again, I was focused more so in the world of sport.
Yeah.
So I targeted or I interviewed athletes who had, you know, had some sort of significant setback in their athletic career that had prevented them from doing the thing that they loved.
Can you give us an example of what a significant setback might be?
Sure. In many instances, it was, say, a catastrophic injury.
Sure. That'll do it.
Yeah.
Tell me about it. Go ahead.
Well, I mean, you think about it. I mean, especially an athlete, for example, who their life is so structured. So, you know, if you were to say, hey, if you were an athlete, Richard, what are you doing, you know, 2 years from now on a Tuesday night at 6 o'clock? The answer would probably be training somewhere, doing something related to my sport. And so all of a sudden, because of this injury, you can no longer do that thing. So it's bad enough that the entire structure of your existence shifts. But then again, your identity has to shift as well, because I'm no longer that thing. And people identify with you as you're the hockey player, or you're the polo player or whatever the thing is.
And, you know, it's interesting you would say that, because that's one of the things throughout my whole life has always driven me a little nuts, okay? So I don't mind sharing this with people. I've never liked being put in a box. And I know that we naturally put people in a box. You are a project manager. You are a business analyst. No, you're a financial person. No, you're a bookkeeper. No, you're a quarterback, right? You're a hockey player. Mm-hmm. And but you're nothing else outside that, which I think is furthest from the truth about people.
And it's interesting. That was what the purpose of my research in that area was about. I targeted people who, we might say, went through that experience and came through it renewed in some way. So they use that, you know, tragic, horrible experience, at least that's the way it presented. They use that as a chance to consider other aspects of who they are, to build capacity in their identity, to add buffers and to project a bit more well-rounded sense of self. And that's important because, especially if you're thinking about sports, I always kid athletes, say, you know, you realize you've chosen this field to pursue that has the shortest window, perhaps, of any other field. I mean, and an accountant doesn't have to worry about retiring at 32. An athlete might.
Yeah, and you have to be prepared for that in many ways. It's interesting because it's like saying, what's the old expression, when one door closes, another door opens?
Yeah.
But you just don't always know, you know, what that's going to look like. I think what would be very interesting, see if how we could translate your whole experience in the sports space. I know we've been sort of playing through your career from an academic perspective, but then how you've used that in terms of working with athletes. But then how do we apply that maybe to sports, but then also a list to the broader category of business?
Sure.
This is Richard Lanford, Set for Success, and we'll be right back. Hello, everyone. Welcome back. I'm hanging out with Dr. Jason Brooks today, and we've been talking about performance coaching, and mostly from a sporting perspective and along the lines of what you've learned, you know, as you've sort of developed academically, but also developed professionally, right, business-wise. The one area I didn't touch on, though, is I know you went off what you studied master-wise, and then what did you do in your PhD? What was your focus there?
In my PhD, I was curious to figure out or answer the question, what do the best people in my field do and how did they get good at what they do? Because I guess when I was coming up, it was frustrating. You'd see these people, you'd gravitate towards them and you'd ask that question. And invariably, I'd get one of two responses. Either A, I don't know how I do what I do, I just do it. Or B, I kind of forgotten what I do and I don't think about it much anymore, but you'll figure it out. And that, in both of those answers, that was very unsatisfying.
Yeah, so it's almost like an organic experience or knowledge, right? You just have it, you've been doing it so long. And yeah. Yeah.
But what's funny is, as I delved deeper into interviewing them, what you found across the board is, in actuality, everybody did have certain underlying processes or practices or routines that they did utilize, you know, to be good, to be ready for the moments that they had
so,
to perform in.
Almost like the sports, the athlete you mentioned, that they actually live a very structured life, just like military, you live
sure.
a very structured life. But those people, if we would pull up from that and step outside of this, and then you tell me, I'm just sort of going with what you said, then those who do tend to be a bit more successful at the things they do, even if they don't, they've never really thought it out, they do have a structure in place.
100%.
They're applying military structure or sports structure mm-hmm. or something that they've learned along the way.
And it's probably tacit at a certain point.
Tacit. Very interesting word.
I mean, it's just, it's automatic. They don't have to think about it.
Yeah.
But make no mistake, maybe at the level of the subconscious, they're preparing mentally and emotionally to go in and meet with a client or to go in a challenging interaction with a team or whatever the situation might be. And I think that's so important because, again, another trick that I do, if that's the right word, when I step into new environments, I'll ask people, I say, okay, who are the ones that are, you know, performing at the highest level, whether it's in business or in medicine or in sport or whatever the context might be. And so, you know, they say, okay, these three or four people. So I'll go and interview them. And the nice thing I can come back to say to the rest of the people is, guess what? They're not special. They have not been blessed with some magical strain in their DNA that the rest of us don't have. But make no mistake, they do certain things. The way that they prepare in advance of certain situations, and then secondly, the way in which that they delve into their experiences afterwards to reflect, to draw lessons, to share their experiences, to apply those lessons, and to get better.
And to adjust if
sure.
necessary and figure out what they can do with it or make a change. I mean, you already used the athlete who had an issue in their life, you know, and then what was the change they made in order to overcome adversity,
mm-hmm.
right?
Well, there's several. I mean, first and foremost, I think just this, having to reconcile that I need to be a bit more than just an athlete, because this career is going to end at a certain point in time. So they saw it as an opportunity that they would not have otherwise had, because their lives were so structured, to step outside of that role and consider, what else do I want to do? What are some other aspects of myself and my personality that I might want to explore? And I think just the shift in perspective from viewing this as this awful, horrible set of circumstances to an opportunity, that in and of itself provided value.
You know, it does. It's interesting. As you're talking, I'm reflecting on my life. I can't help it, right? And then I'm thinking about other people too. But, you know, I've always thought that people are very holistic. But yet we might only, as we talked about in earlier segments, we might only see them one way. And as a professional athlete, maybe, is I think what I hear you saying, you might only identify when you're in the middle of your career sort of one way, but then something happens, then you have to expand beyond your own thinking.
Sure. And I would say it's a predominant identification. In some cases, people, it is entire, but for most people, if you want to be really good at something, it's understandable that it would be a predominant part of who you see yourself as. And Richard, I've seen it in business, I've seen it in medicine, in any other performance context. It's certainly not.
Yeah, and that's interesting you would say that, because my next question for you was, how does this all apply to business? Like, we've been sort of talking about the sports side, which I know applies, right? Mm-hmm. But what are some of the key things that maybe you see from a performance coaching, performance management, performance perspective in business?
Sure. Well, I'm going to go all the way back to your intro to the program, because I thought you nailed it. This idea that we're all performers. I mean, so human performance is human performance. Whether one is in the context of sport or business or whatever, we are all blessed with the same internal operating system. You know, thoughts and feelings that can work for us or work against us. So we are susceptible as human beings to distracting thoughts, to heightened emotions, to stress and anxiety and things of that nature, to having to deal with difficult outcomes in whatever our particular performance realm. And so the ideas that we bring from the world of, say, peak performance and human psychology is designed with this species in mind, to help people gain efficiencies and develop processes to deal with the inevitable human challenges that can present in whatever it is that one does.
It's interesting, we put down, you know, processes, or you say processes, I say processes, but then dealing with the human condition overall. Mm-hmm. Is there an example you might be able to provide, maybe from somebody you've worked with, without saying who they are, you know, where you've had to overcome some things?
Sure. I mean, we could talk about it in terms of stress. We could talk about it in terms of communication. I'll do both.
Well, yeah, stress, communication. I mean, those are two big topics that no doubt our listeners today have to deal with, you know.
If you think of acute stress, for example, I mean, one of the things that people fear the most, in my experience, regardless of professional context, is uncertainty. And I've worked with a lot of people who that's probably one of the defining features of what they do. Let's take physicians, for example. You know, if I just say, hey, what's coming through the OR today or the emerge? I have no idea. And second question, are you going to be ready to deal with that challenge? I hope so. So already we're starting from a deficit in terms of certainty. But yet at the same time, helping people understand that they can be readier in advance for those kinds of situations that they would know instinctively could have the potential to take them away from feeling and focusing and performing as they can. And so I help inoculate them from some of those particular stressful situations by, again, whether it's doing a bit of rehearsal and imagery in advance, whether it's being just a little bit more mindful of their energy and the way in which what they say and how they interpret what might happen in that situation can help or hinder their ability to be present and to perform to their potential.
You know, that's a great explanation. And as you were talking about that and making, you know, saying what you're saying, I was thinking about, over the course of my career, all the different clients I've worked with, and especially in the small to mid-range business enterprise level. And often when we're looking at roadmaps for those organizations, we have to look at what the standardized processes are. And if you think about it a little bit further, and some of them are so small, we look at task-based types of processes, but really we're setting them up so they can deal with any issue that comes in because they have an approach to it. This is what happens. Here's what I do. A, B, C, D, rate the Z, way we go. And I think with your physician example in the emergency ER, I guess it is emergency ER, same thing, you know, that's what you're saying, right? Mm-hmm. You set them up with their training, so under adverse conditions or uncertainty, they can actually deal with what's coming forward.
Absolutely.
Is that the concept?
Precisely, sure.
Yeah. So you know, sort of building upon that, you were talking a bit about stressful situations and that, and then you mentioned about communication. What's the communication component?
Boy, there's so much. I mean, communication is just absolute currency. I mean, it to me, communication and leadership, if we're talking business or any other professional realm, it's just the lowest of low-lying fruit that there is. I mean, it costs nothing, and yet the impact it can make in terms of organizational culture, in terms of productivity, in terms of people feeling empowered and providing ultimate value to an organization, I mean, it's just, you can't even measure it.
You know, since it's so big, okay, I think what we should do is take a short break. We'll come back and we'll start off with communication. We'll talk about that. This is Richard Lamford, Set for Success. We'll be right back. Hello, everyone. Welcome back. I'm hanging out today with Dr. Jason Brooks. And just in our last segment, Jason, we were chatting a little bit about communications, organizations. You mentioned words like culture. You mentioned more than that. I mean, it's a pretty big topic, everything from performance, which we've been talking about, from the culture of an organization to very rudimentary type communication. So I guess maybe we'll start off with a very simple question, a bit complex. What are some of the communication challenges that you've experienced in working with clientele, whether it's in sports or on business, you know?
Sure. I mean, obviously dealing with difficult personalities is one. Having a disconnect at times between what we're trying to communicate versus what is being interpreted by the other. There's so much research in terms of body language, for example, that can attest to that. Upwards of 80 to 90% of how we derive meaning from interaction is based on body language. And so if your words aren't matching what you're giving off, you know, people might be distrustful or skeptical, and that can cause all kinds of communication conundrums. My suggestions, I think, for most people, I mean, there's sort of a few top 10 things, if you will. I won't mention 10, but some key ones for people to consider is, first and foremost, I mean, if two of us are engaged in some conversation that's important, I always say to people, start with the end that you want in mind and stay there. One of the two of us has to make sure that the train stays on the track, so to speak. And if one of us becomes defensive and that starts to veer off and then I match that defensiveness, now neither one of us is getting anything that we would have wanted.
It's interesting that you would start off as that as one of the tips. Right. And we should do several tips on this one. Mm-hmm. I interview a lot of clients one-on-one and CEOs and executive senior managers because of the nature of the work I do. I'm not talking about the radio show. I'm talking about now professionally my other clients' stuff. And periodically I'll ask a question. And now I do have an end in mind. Right. I have to acquire certain information to be able to move forward and create what's called a current state situation for the organization. But periodically, I'll ask a question and the person will get defensive. Like, why do you need to know that? What are you asking that question for? Is that the kind of defensiveness that you're talking about?
Absolutely.
Or is that an example of it?
And if you matched that defensiveness with further defensiveness, now we get nowhere.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. A lot of times I actually have the state, I'll use my example here. I guess I have the state back to that person. Listen, you know, I'm just asking key questions. There's no right or wrong here. And you know, I don't have any ulterior motive other than I'm just creating a current state situation. Mm-hmm. And it's okay just to sort of talk about this stuff. And then they sort of relax, right?
Exactly.
They sort of, you know, I handle it depending on the person, right? But roughly just restating what your purpose is.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And keeping the train on the right track.
There you go. So I'm just supporting your example.
Yeah.
Exactly. Give us another tip.
One thing I think that people don't appreciate as much is just checking the state that they're in. Like if I'm trying to communicate something to you and I've just come out of something that was intense, you know, a difficult interaction or a stressful situation, I might not be in the best state of mind and state of energy to communicate effectively. And conversely, if I need to get something across to you that's important, are you in the right state? Have you just come out of that scenario? And now I'm going to try and, you know, inundate you with something that I need you to do. And instantly it could cause that same defensiveness or distraction because you're just not ready to receive it. So if there's the opportunity to delay that for me to say, Richard, I got something important to tell you. Maybe now is not the best time. What's a good time? I mean, that in of itself can create a whole lot of communication problems.
Yeah. Or to learn the lessons how to do that well, just have teenagers. Sorry. I just had to throw that in because you discover very quickly communications is about timing, yeah. placement and timing, and, you know, when they're ready to receive things. But I think very much if we tie that back in the business, that could be with your staff, your resources, your peers, the same idea.
Absolutely. You
know, how often have we all had that bad night's sleep where we've dreamt all sorts of stuff and we've gotten up in a bad mood? And we've gotten up in a bad mood because of what we dreamt. Try to talk to somebody in that space.
Exactly.
You know, it just doesn't work. Yeah. I know I'm simplifying it and everything, but I'm just trying to sort of slide in just some
Those
sort of
great illustrations
that people do, you know. And I guess the other piece of that, if we're talking communication, how do you shift the person? Okay, so if you're not ready to receive or have a dialogue with somebody, is it possible to actually shift the person and their thinking, to shift their mood and stuff? And that's always fascinated me, that sort of concept. Have you ever thought about that?
Absolutely. And I think the first and most important thing that one can do is just provide a bit of empathy. There's a reason why someone is in the mood that they are. So if I can take a second to relate to them at a human level and just say, Richard, you okay? Like, what's going on today? You don't seem your normal self, or seem a bit more defensive or agitated than is normal. And next thing you know, go, oh, you know, I had a restless night. I've been worrying about this big business proposal or whatever it was. So instantly now there's a sense of them being a bit more disarmed. Yeah. Once they're disarmed because they've felt a bit more understood, now they're in a much better state perhaps to consider whatever it is that you're wanting them to pay attention
to. It's interesting you would say about that. I was worried about this or that overnight. One of my favorite questions to ask somebody, especially, you know, when I'm doing my work side, I generally don't do this to friends, but maybe. I'll set a scenario. It's like 3 or 4 a.m. in the morning. You know, you wake up. What are you thinking about? You know, and you'd be surprised what kind of answers when you ask somebody that question you get. You know, and I've heard everything from, you know, where are we not going to succeed today, to is this deal going to fall apart, to, you know, I'm concerned about my kid graduating high school. Like, I've heard all sorts of stuff. And people have so many different things going on that, you know, we have to be aware of what's happening in their lives. You mentioned about difficult people. Mm-hmm. Right away, you can't say that word without me asking about it. What do you mean by a difficult person or difficult people?
Well, I think that there are all types of personalities, obviously, in any workplace, in any professional setting. And we have to learn to navigate through those effectively to get anything done. I think if we went on the extreme end, you know, sort of the more alpha type of personality, someone who can be very dismissive and demeaning in terms of how they communicate with others. So I always encourage people to consider two things with regards to that. Number one, we cannot own what I will call their personality nuances or flaws. We can't own that. They're going to be who they're going to be. What we can't do as well is we cannot allow them to hijack our response and our reaction to who they are. That is something that's you versus you. You need to be readier in advance of those situations, knowing who they are, to respond how you want to respond.
So that sounds to me like that's a whole other topic we get into: passive-aggressive behavior, mm-hmm. assertiveness in communication. So there's a whole area that we can just dialogue there. Jason, if somebody wanted to get in touch with you, how would they go about doing that?
I think the two best ways, I do have a website that I've put out there for physicians.
Yeah.
It's more physician-centric, but certainly the performance principles would be applicable to anybody in any field. That website is www.phenomenaldocs.com.
Yep.
And then I also have probably the best email to get a hold of me would be drjbro@gmail.com. And doctor is actually spelled out D-O-C-T-O-R. jbro@gmail.com.
You know, I'm going to call you J-Bro from now on.
Well, it's funny. That's where it came from. That was the nickname that my mentor I mentioned earlier, Cal Botterill, slapped on me about 20 years ago, and it's just stuck.
Just stuck. J-Bro. I like that far better. What a show we've been having. I'm just having an awesome time talking to you about this whole topic of performance. If you had one final thought you could leave our listeners, what would it be?
I think too often we lose sight of why we do what we do. And there was a great speaker who once said, you know, burnout, for example, we don't get burned out because of what we do. We get burned out because we lose sight of why we do it. And so I encourage people, stay connected to some sense of purpose and passion in what you do that is stronger than the tough stuff and the distracting stuff and the challenging stuff. Because if you can shift your attention back to why you do it, you're going to persevere and you're going to be successful.
Awesome. I think that's great advice. Dr. Jason Brooks, thank you for being on my show today. You're a great guest, and I appreciate all the insights. As for the listeners, you know I want to thank you for tuning in. If you have a question, a thought, an idea for a show, just send me an email at richard@setforsuccess.ca. And do remember, do your best, invest in the success of others, and make your journey count.